Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello, 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 my wonderful audience. You can tell by my intro that this is my radio TV show. If I am not introducing it with my wonderful audience, I'm just making a video. So you'll be seeing videos from me, and you'll also be seeing me on the TV show. And the way it works is wonderfulprn.fm has me on the radio live every Wednesday at 4 p.m. And then that is recorded, and we put up the recording within a day or so afterward on my YouTube. So you go to Breggin's YouTube channel. You can recognize it's the channel because there's a nice green, lovely scene of farms with bales of hay. And there you can see this weekly TV version of the radio show of the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour on PRN.fm. Today I'm going to do something very, very special. I'm going to spend an hour talking about psychiatric drugs. This is the area, of course, that I've had the most influence in, the most impact on. And I want to make this an introduction to psychiatric drugs, and in particular to their harms, that is the best you can find anywhere. That's my goal. The first thing you need to know about psychiatric drugs is that they do not cure biochemical imbalances. They do not do anything good for the brain that we know, that they are in fact neurotoxins. So all their effects can be evaluated in terms of what particular harm is that. So let's suppose you've taken an antidepressant or a stimulant drug and you're feeling better than ever, best day you've had in a long time. You're probably having a euphoric response, a euphoria to the initial stages of the intoxication, the first few days, which is really quite common from a number of different drugs. Because one of the ways the brain reacts to any injury, whether it's neurotoxic or electroshock or a hit on the head that produces a state of a traumatic brain injury or a concussion, you know, it doesn't matter what the event is that harms the brain. Initially, they often have a euphoric sort of, I'm fine, leave me alone, I'm doing great, feel to it. And this leads people to think that an antidepressant has helped them, but it only lasts a week or so. And then the brain gradually produces an apathy or a loss of feeling, a lack of engagement, a lack of caring, a lack of involvement in the world around. And this may be experienced by your wife or your husband or your friend as your less irritable and less angry and less upset, or it may be experienced for what it is, which is you're really out of touch with me. You're not engaged. You didn't even greet the dog when you came home today. So all the effects of psychiatric drugs come not from improvements, but from there being neurotoxins. Now, in addition to the effect of a brief euphoria, if it lasts a long time, you're really in trouble and can go into a mania. And many of the cases I see, by the way, of violence on drugs have an aspect of a mania to them. And so do the suicides sometimes, and the person crashes from the mania to the depression. But the basic long-term effect is not the euphoria, It's not the mania. It's either a sedative effect, if you're taking a sedative, or it's this apathy. The apathy is a lobotomy-like effect. We're causing lobotomy-like effects in people long-term. So this is the brain-disabling effect, what I call the brain-disabling effect of psychiatric drugs. Now, the idea that psychiatric drugs are neurotoxins is so extreme to the layperson and to many physicians and even psychiatrists, because it's just incompatible with all the claims which are led by drug company propaganda and drug company sponsored research. So I want to show you that if you get out of the field of psychiatry, it's a generally accepted fact in the study of neurotoxins that psychiatric drugs are neurotoxins. Here is a book. It's from a very esteemed series of volumes called Psychiatric Clinics of North America. And here's one of the volumes, which are each one's a series of psychiatric papers. And this one is Psychiatric Manifestations of Neurotoxins. So what it is showing is, what are the psychiatric effects of neurotoxins? And what are the neurotoxins it's examining? Every single class of psychiatric drug is included in this book. The mood stabilizers, the antidepressants, the stimulants, the benzodiazepines. There is no group of psychiatric drugs that is not included in this, looking at their neurotoxicity. Now, very quickly, and then I'll put this book down and be talking to you face to face, I want to give you their definition in this book on neurotoxicity, and in particular neurotoxins that produce psychiatric effects. And neurotoxicity is the disruption of the nervous system resulting from exposure to environmental toxins. So that's very interesting. They're not even saying that the neurotoxin, the environmental neurotoxin, has to produce death of cells or severe disabling of cells, which all psychiatric drugs do. All can do that. And then they briefly discuss the fact that these neurotoxins make changes in neurological function. That's what every psychiatric drug does. It doesn't improve it, but it makes changes, and these changes are harmful. And the examples they give of a particularly common changes are mood and psychiatric disturbances. And among the changes in more detail are all the horrible things that psychiatric drugs can do. So I want you to see that this comes from their neurotoxicity. So mood changes that are often seen to varying degrees in neurotoxicity include increased anxiety, depression, irritability, impulsivity, and psychosis. And then they go on to say that heavy metals, drugs, and many other things can do this. So looking at a book that is not interested particularly in defending psychiatry, but is investigating what neurotoxins produce serious psychiatric consequences, we find that psychiatric drugs, which always impair neurological function, are neurotoxins by definition, and that they go on to produce this litany of impulsivity, mood changes, which means depression, and so on and so forth. Now, that is what especially happens in the first months. But I want to come back to the fact that long term, what psychiatric drugs or any neurotoxins are likely to do to you is to produce these lobotomy-like effects of apathy, indifference, lack of engagement, and so on. That's an important, very important concept. Now, since all neurotoxins produce these effects, we can assume that psychiatric effects from drugs will be very similar. And so if you look up almost any psychiatric drugs, full prescribing information, you just plug it in full prescribing information into Google for your drug, you will find sections which basically list the very same list of effects that I just read to you. So if you go into antidepressants, which are so widely used, and I'll times focus on them, you'll find that exact same litany. And in fact, that litany was taken largely from a journal article I wrote in the Journal of Risk and Safety in Medicine, in which the executive director of the hearings on adverse effects of antidepressants had sent to, in the small package they get of things to read, they got my article, which lists that litany, which includes anxiety, irritability, anger, mood changes, psychosis, and something called akathisia, which they don't mention there. They do elsewhere in the book. And akathisia, which is a horrible feeling of being tortured so you can't sit still, that stimulants produce this, the antidepressants. But if you go and you look at amphetamine, full prescribing information, you're going to find the same litany, and you'll find some variation of it in most of the full prescribing informations, the only exceptions usually being very old full prescribing informations that haven't been updated. Ironically, even the sedative benzos have a list of paradoxical effects, and these include a very similar litany, including aggressivity and irritability and mood changes. So here we have a situation in which the public has been just fed a whole bunch of malarkey about fixing non-existent biochemical imbalances when patients are being given drugs that cause in the normal brain of people or animals multiple biochemical imbalances with a litany of abnormalities. Now, this is interesting because this is what we know about psychiatric drugs. We can't really prove that they work. Let me repeat that. I'm coming to explain it to you. And by the way, if you want the hundreds of articles that I've read that have gone into this and you want to look at it from a scientific viewpoint, go to Bregan.com and look up some of my 60 or so scientific articles, peer-reviewed articles, or look at Brain Disabling Effects, my book, Brain Disabling Effects of Psychiatric Treatments, and take a look at that in the second volume, or the most recent, another medical book, which is Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, the first half of which discusses everything I'm talking about today in detail with all the scientific references, and also go to some of my other YouTube discussions of psychiatric drugs, which may focus not so much on the huge overview that I'm doing today, but they will focus instead on one aspect or another in one group of drugs or another. So again, all psychiatric drugs are neurotoxins. Initially, they can produce everything under the sun in the way of abnormal reactions, psychiatric. Your psychiatrist or your pediatrician or your general practitioners who give out most of these drugs, they're likely to tell you, or you tell you as the patient or the parent, that your manic tendencies are being unmasked or your irritability is being unmasked. They are not likely to directly tell you that your drug is neurotoxin and you're having the very well-known and studied array of reactions to almost all neurotoxins, including psychiatric drugs. They just won't do that. Now, neurotoxins have an array of effects that start with minor irritability, minor euphoria, minor, lesser depressive feelings, and so on, lesser degrees of feeling out of touch and so on. And these then go up to extremes because they're neurotoxins. And every single psychiatric drug has extremes of neurotoxicity. Every class of drugs has extremes of neurotoxicity. And because the human brain is so variable and drug effects are so variable, often for reasons we have no idea why, psychiatric drugs in general can produce this extreme neurotoxicity at normally taken doses. So if you look at the full prescribing information again for drugs like the amphetamines and the benzos and the antidepressants and the neuroleptic drugs, you know, the basic classes, they're going to say somewhere, usually at the end, that these extreme responses can occur at normal doses, but are more likely at higher doses of the drugs. And they're usually more likely when the drug dose goes up or the drug dose goes down. So they can happen during withdrawal. Because see, when the balance in the brain, the homeostasis that it's attempting to create with the toxin by ramping up its defense mechanisms, for example, if you're tending toward euphoria on the drug, the brain's going to try to sedate you or slow you down. And if you're getting sedated on the drug and apathetic and kind of remote, it may energize you to relate, you know, push you up and just make you just the opposite of the drug. And withdrawal is usually the opposite of the drug effect because withdrawal is where the brain is unmasked to just do its job. So if you get sort of relaxed from smoking cigarettes, when you stop in 10 minutes, you're in withdrawal and you're irritable and you need to have another cigarette. Or if you've been drinking a lot for a few days or more, when you stop, instead of feeling sedated as the alcohol is making you do, you're going to get hyper and maybe even have seizures if you've been, you know, on the drugs for a few weeks. So these neurotoxic effects can be very severe, and they can occur, especially when you start the drug or change the dose or stop the drug. So, for example, the severe neurotoxic effect of the antipsychotic drugs like Seroquel, which is usually masqueraded as a sleeping pill, or Abilify, or Thorazine, or Risperdal, any of the antipsychotic drugs, they produce something called neuroleptic malignant syndrome. That's a heck of a word. NMS, neuroleptic malignant syndrome. And in that syndrome, you can get a whole array of abnormal movements. Usually the people who are trying to minimize the disease say, well, the key characteristic is of neuroleptic malignant syndrome is a stiffness. Well, it's actually any of the abnormal movements that can be produced and look like tardive dyskinesia. You can get grimacing and twitching and spasming and movements and just akathisia, which is just a terrible torture I mentioned to you earlier. So you want to keep moving. And in the extreme, it can kill you. Untreated, the main treatment is just a lot of physical support. 20% death rate. Now, again, this not only demonstrates for you the dangers of these drugs, because it's neuroleptic malignant syndrome, which is almost always called rare by the experts, all of whom, except maybe two or three of us internationally, are in the pay of the drug companies. So you want to get the truth, you got to go to somebody like me or Peter Goetz or somebody else, you know, who's not in the pay one way or another of the drug companies. So I'm telling you about the terrible neurotoxic effects, both to show you that these drugs are neurotoxins, to show you the risks. Well, the antidepressants, they have their equivalent of neuroleptic malignant syndrome, the serotonin syndrome. And that is a little different usually because there isn't that's all that stuff of the the kind of suppressing of the brain that takes place, and I didn't mention that to you, the cognitive defects that are very suppressive, and you get really apathetic, because the serotonin syndrome tends to stimulate you more. So you're going to get cognitive deficits, but it's more likely to be more manic or more super excited or euphoric. And it, too, has a number of fatalities associated with it. Then there's lithium. Lithium is so neurotoxic. I mean, what was advertised by NIMH in the beginning, way back, as a magic bullet to control mania is really just a severe neurotoxin that would slow any mental processes down, including mania. I laugh because it's so stupid. It makes me anxious to this day to think about what we do to our patients, because I'm a psychiatrist, and you know, this is just hard for me at times to look at. Well, the lithium intoxicate, the serotonin intoxication just charges you up. The lithium intoxication is a real subduing of everything, and you don't know it's coming. Usually you don't know any of these things are coming. You just lapse into them, and it is so neurotoxic, lithium, that you have to take blood tests regularly, because you won't know it's creeping up on you, but your blood test will show if you're just a little bit above a certain window, boy, you're just at high risk. And what used to be thought of as the normal range of treatment is now, you know, narrowing a little bit because of this, you know, high risk of severe neurotoxicity. So, and overstimulation with the stimulants is very obvious. People who have reactions to stimulants, they get very, very hyper, very overexcited. They have problems with their cardiovascular system. They can have heart attacks. And that's a very dangerous state as well. Looking at the benzodiazepines, you know, they sedate. So if you actually take enough benzo, you will go into a state of anesthesia unconsciousness in which surgery can be done on you. And in fact, most surgical anesthetics are derivatives of the BZs, the benzodiazepines, like Xanax and Valium and Cerax and clonazepam and so on. So again, stopping for a moment for me to take a breath in this long and I hope very informative talk, you know, we are looking at neurotoxins, and that is the way to understand how these drugs work. And that's also true. I could go into that and discuss it with alcohol and marijuana and LSD. They're all neurotoxins. Don't kid yourself. None of them, even though they may make you on some level feel better, are making your brain better. Your brain is complaining mightily, and it's likely to produce serious adverse reactions on withdrawal, often very unpredictable adverse reactions. Now, what about the permanency of these kinds of reactions? This is a sad and tragic conversation. We have evidence for permanent injury to the brain from every class of psychiatric drug, including antidepressants, including the antipsychotic drugs, including the stimulant drugs, and including the benzodiazepine drugs. In fact, in all those classes of drugs, there are long-term studies showing some degree of atrophy of the brain in a statistically significant number of patients, usually along with difficulties with thinking and the difficulties with judgment and difficulties in particular. The early signs of these difficulties are short-term memory loss, where you have to make lists of things, where you don't remember what your mom or your husband or a friend asked you to do. Those are very early signs. They look very much like early dementia, like Alzheimer's disease. So All psychiatric drugs produce a risk, a significant risk of brain damage that can be seen on various kinds of brain scans, including MRIs. And they all produce significant injury to cognitive functioning, which can be found on the most sensitive way for testing for it is a good clinical interview, and they will even show up often on neuropsychological testing. And this is just a fact. And again, I go over all this in my book, Brain Disabling Treatments in Psychiatry, the second edition, and which is a really a medical book by a medical publisher, and also another book, medical book by a medical publisher, which is my psychiatric drug withdrawal book, and also in a whole array, go to my website, Bregan.com, in a whole array of more popular books like Talking Back to Prozac and the Antidepressant Fact Book and the Ritalin Fact Book and similar, simpler drugs, simpler books about drugs. But they all have tons of scientific references in there. Back of the book, and they're cited during the text, unobtrusively during the text. I want to move on now and talk a little bit about psychiatric drug withdrawal. All psychoactive substances are likely to have symptoms of withdrawal. The shorter acting the drug, the quicker it gets out of your system, the more traumatic the withdrawal in general. Thus, Xanax, the short acting, high punch benzo, is likely to have more severe withdrawal than the longer acting, less punchy Valium or diazepam. But it's not necessarily so. The problem with drugs and the brain and people is that you can make generalizations, but don't ever try to live or die by them. Always be cautious. Always expect the worst, in particular when you're making dose changes. And the brain has to find a way to accommodate to them, and that includes withdrawal. So that's a very basic starting principle that drug withdrawal is caused in good part by the brain compensating and producing effects which are then unmasked. And again, using a simple alcohol, remember that, as I mentioned earlier, alcohol is suppressing your brain and sedating it. And so when you stop, your brain's all agitated and anxious, and it can even go into convulsions because it's been so jacked up and it needs time to recover. It needs time to recover. And it may, in the case of alcohol and many drugs, the recovery may far outlast what looks like the initial recovery. So you may do your 10 days for alcohol or something like, or for benzos in a hospital and be told that you're in recovery now, but you may not really be recovering fully for months or years. Many people experience this. Again, the higher the doses, the longer exposure, the more risk, greater risk of permanent harm. If you're trying to take your child off of Ritalin or any of the amphetamine derivatives, of which there are multiples that you can look up in the back of my books or on the internet, especially Adderall, because it's just pure amphetamine. Children are often surprisingly able to come off of these drugs if they're being given within the accepted range that you can find in the full prescribing information. So if your child has been coming off every weekend, off of his Adderall or off of his Ritalin or Focalin, your child may be able to come off and stay off. You have to think about it a lot and think of how does your child do in those 2 days. And especially if your child's coming off over Thanksgiving or Christmas routinely or over the summer and doing well, that gives you a sign that maybe you could take your child off short term, take your child off maybe by halving in a day or two, but only if you know well from experience that your child does really good under those circumstances. It's not my first recommendation. I would recommend when you can removing your child over the summer or over a longer period of time and following the recommendations that I make to avoid too much depression, because they can go into depression, they can go into irritability and anger, they can get suicidal, they can eat a lot. They can have trouble sleeping and so on and so forth. So, you know, be real cautious. But at least I want to reassure parents that, generally speaking, that you can take your child off of these drugs. But then you need to think about, do I tell the teacher? Can I trust the school to know what I'm doing? Hopefully you have a good professional monitoring this. And it gets a little more complicated. So take a look at my books on the subject, or take a look at some of my other videos about psychiatric drug withdrawal or about stimulant drugs. These are just examples. I'm just trying to give you a general idea about withdrawal, but always, always be very cautious, including with your children. If they've been on for months and months, you've just really got to read up about it, learn about it, and try to get a good professional. And very often it won't be your psychiatrist, but more likely will be a general practitioner who's really seen some of the harms, is more open to understanding the harms, and more likely to want to encourage you. And tend to avoid anybody, although I just suggested on certain circumstances you might be able to do it. Avoid in general anybody who tells you, any doctor, well, if you want to come often, we'll have them and then we'll stop. Because in general, that's a disaster. In general, that's a mistake. And could be the result of doctor being angry about being asked to go ahead and take you off the drugs. They can get upset about this. I'm taking a breath here. I'm working mostly spontaneous, just from the kind of minimal notes. Because I want to just be very real with you as I'm talking about all these different issues. Let's look now at the effectiveness of drugs. It's very, very interesting. We know with certainty, we can prove with certainty that every single psychiatric drug has terrible, horrible effects. We know it. How do you know it? Well, just go look in the full prescribing information on the list of adverse effects for any psychiatric drug in these little, short, miserable 4 to 6 weeks, highly biased studies. Oh, I didn't mention, actually, these studies. Most studies, like for Prozac, they were 4 to 6 weeks. They wanted to go 6 or 8, I think, but too many patients drop out from adverse effects. They'd love to do 6-month studies and show you how wonderful they are, but they can't. They can't because the drugs have so many adverse effects and do so little good for people in general that they stay that they can't do short-term studies very well. For example, the Xanax studies for panic disorder, they wanted them to go about 12 weeks or so, and they ended up ending them at 8 weeks, because at 6 weeks, the patients were worse than they were before. But they didn't report it that way up, John. They reported it as patients were doing somewhat better at 6 weeks, but they didn't mention the 8 weeks. And I'm not the only one that noticed that. There were a group of British psychologists and psychiatrists who noticed it and wrote to the journal it was published in, complaining about it, and I think 18 months later, when it was much too late, the journal published their letter. Well, the journal editor was on the payroll of Upjohn. I wrote him a letter and said, I mean, do you think it's fair for you to be the journal editor who organizes all of the peer review and who touts the drug, to not be telling people that you're actually a consultant uptown? And he wrote back to me, what are you, a Marxist? God, this is one of my first really big disillusioning interactions with my colleagues. What are you, a Marxist? Because I think he's being influenced by the money he's taking from the drug company. So, I mean, these are the kind of people that are saying the drugs work. They're all on one or another drug company payroll. And the people who do these very short-term studies, they are either directly on the drug company payroll or they're working for a company that does the studies for the drug company. And if you were a drug company executive, would you hire somebody who gave your studies a thumbs down? I don't think so. I don't think so. It's very hard to find people who will give up their job, a big source of their income, by going against what the people who are hiring them want to hear. It's an interesting situation that I get into in an odd way that I've never talked about, which is I get hired to be an expert against drug companies. I get hired to be an expert against doctors and facilities that have been giving drugs. And when I'm sent the data from the people who want to hire me, they don't want me to do what the drug company experts routinely do, which is to give them what they want to hear. They don't want me to say, this is a great lawsuit, and then they'll go spend a lot of money on it, often out of their pocket, sometimes out of the pocket of the person who's been injured. That's the last person you want to be injured some more. They want me to tell them the truth because they don't want to get into these situations. So just last week, you know, I was sent a case that had to do with a suicidal person who killed themselves, and I had to say, no, I don't think you're going to get anywhere with this case. There's too many other confounding factors other than the hospital that treated this person and discharged them. There's all the other treatments they've had, the fact this person's been suicidal before, the fact that this person had a lot of stressors going on. I don't think I can say with any certainty that it was just the hospital discharging him prematurely, and I don't think a jury is going to accept that. And they didn't say, no, you know, you got to say what we want. Well, they didn't say that because what they want is an honest evaluation. They want me to say, yes, I'll participate, I'll go into court if necessary, and I'll say that these drugs in your case hurt people, but I've looked at it and I can't say that. They want both facts because they want to be spending a lot of money on a case that's no good. Now, the drug companies, when they are developing a drug like Xanax or Prozac or Abilify, they don't want their experts to say this drug doesn't work or this drug is too toxic. They fire those kind of experts because their interest is themselves, their jobs, and their stockholders. And the well-being of the patients, oh, it's so far away. What they do, if they get a bad reaction sent into them that's beginning to look really bad, like when it really became obvious that Prozac was causing violence and suicide, I was the first one to discuss that in a very serious way, in books, for example, in lengthy review articles. The first thing the drug company did was set up a committee to fight against it, not a committee to look into it. And the FDA, the first thing they did is started meeting secretly early in the morning so no one would see them meeting together, you know, going in and out of the offices in Bethesda, Maryland. So, I mean, as soon as there's a drug disaster, the FDA and the drug companies collaborate to try to mute it. That's why these things go on. Then eventually, if the FDA just can't escape it, or a government, another government agency like the Justice Department has a huge suit against the drug company or something like that, then they may admit to this terrible thing going on. So despite they're trying desperately not to put adverse effects in their full prescribing information, the full prescribing informations are full of them. And very often, it's so interesting, very often they will mimic what I read to you about anxiety and irritability and mood changes and things like that, insomnia and so on. Because when you take a neurotoxin, it's going to impair the brain. And as the brain becomes impaired, it gets more and more stereotypical in what it can do. It just can do less and less. So by the time you're on the neurotoxin lithium or the neurotoxin, a neuroleptic drug like Risperdal or Abilify or Seroquel and so on, it all begins to look the same. And so if you're in my position, you get to evaluate people on four or five drugs, they all look a lot the same. They're all apathetic. They're all indifferent. They all don't know what's happening to them. So that brings me to one of the most important findings that of my own research that is being picked up by some brave scientists, and which should have been picked up decades ago because it's very simple, is this. And everybody knows it, but nobody wants to say it or acknowledge it. And that is that all neurotoxic drugs, from alcohol and marijuana down to the psychiatric drugs, all of them interfere with the individual's ability to know about having symptoms from the drugs. So the first thing happens when somebody starts to get apathetic on the drugs is they deny it. It's the family who notices it, the girlfriend who notices it. The patient doesn't. I call it a medication spellbinding. And in my scientific articles, I give it a more scientific name, intoxication anosognosia. Being intoxicated and anosognosia, not knowing. Intoxication anosognosia. This intoxication anosognosia was first noticed in purely neurological cases, where a person might even have an impairment of a limb and they wouldn't know it. And then another neurologist began to talk about almost all neurologically injured patients had an anosognosia named Fisher, neurologist named Fisher. And all this is in my books and in my scientific articles. I have one on medication spellbinding. And when I heard that, I said, yeah, boy, that makes sense. All neurological injury produces frontal lobe effects, judgment effects, and for whatever other reasons, because it's so common that it's really hard to know why. But people and that's just to defend oneself psychologically, but it's so consistent, I think it's neurologic. People go into denial when their brains are injured. So I thought to myself, well, is that happening with patients? And I said, well, of course, it's well recognized, for example, with tardive dyskinesia. We have scientific articles showing that the abnormal movements inflicted upon patients by antipsychotic drugs, the patients often deny the existence of. I said, well, let me look some more. And then after reviewing it all, I found that pretty much you'll find in the literature, and always you'll find in your clinical experience, that many, if not most, patients who have injuries from psychiatric drugs deny them. So then imagine how many more reports there'd be in the literature, how many more reports there'd be in the full prescribing information if the patients were coming in their 4 to 6 weeks trials and saying, oh my God, I feel so lackadaisical, doc. But they're not. They're coming in and saying, well, I'm less upset now. They don't know what's happening to them. So if patients weren't being drugged into a submissive, unknowing state of being, they'd be reporting so much more and knowing so much more. So patients stay on their drugs for long periods of time for two basic reasons, maybe more. But one is intoxication and anosognosia. In fact, you know, I mentioned earlier that the patients who are taking lithium have their blood tested. Why is that? Well, it's because of intoxication and anosognosia. They have toxic levels in their blood and they don't even recognize what's happening to them. And in those cases, again, it's going to be the parents who call the doctors and say, my husband, my son, my wife, you know, is really really bad shape, doc. And the doc will say, well, let's try. And then they say, well, I think it might be the lithium. I say, oh, no. Lithium doesn't do that, doctors will say. And there's a ton of literature on neurotoxicity from lithium. A ton of literature and a neurotoxic syndrome that goes along with it. So again, just looking at all this as I'm trying to weave this web for you, not give you a boring 1, 2, 3 thing. We don't realize what's happening to us when we're being harmed by psychiatric drugs. And one of the main reasons is neuroleptic spellbinding. I mean, psychiatric drug spellbinding. Now, when a person feels that they can't stop the drugs, which is probably almost everybody on every drug, what's going on? Why do they think they can't stop the drugs? Why does a woman, and 20%, I think, more of women, I mean, those are official statistics. What do you think the real ones are? So let's say 20 or 30% of women, they feel they can't get off the drugs, even if they want to, because they immediately get distressed. Well, one of the reasons is that medication spellbinding also covers and affects you during withdrawal, so you don't stop to think, maybe this is withdrawal. Maybe this is withdrawal. And your doctor is almost none of the time going to tell you it is. He's just going to tell you, hey, you don't stay on the drugs. You need them. That's not true at all. That's no more true than if you told an alcoholic who stopped for 2 days and got the DTs that, hey, man, stay in your alcohol. You need it. That's that big a lie. It's such a betrayal. It's such a horrible betrayal when my colleagues, my prescribing colleagues are doing to people. The worst of the part of the betrayal I laid on my psychiatric association, of which I remain a member. I want people to know, yeah, I belong. I'm looking at them. I'm one of them. And then the drug companies who run the psychiatric association. That's where I see the culprits. Even though most of the prescribing is on a lower level, if just maybe 10 more psychiatrists than me out of the, I don't know, 40,000 or whatever there are, if 10 more than me said what I'm saying, and certainly 10 more know it. I know plenty who know it, but they don't want to go through what I go through. So they don't say anything. But if 10 more did, this whole thing had collapsed. They know that. So medication spellbinding is keeping you, when you try to withdraw, from realizing the trouble you're in, from your withdrawal symptoms, and that it is withdrawal, and it all started when you came off the drug, with usually within hours or a day or two. And the other thing that happens during withdrawal that's so important, which I haven't mentioned yet, is that during withdrawal, the drug is no longer hiding from you how injured you are. So there's a direct drug effect that's going on that's obscuring. That's not just the spellbinding effect. The neurotoxicity of the drug is keeping you from being able to perceive your memory problems, your emotional problems, and all those other things. So when you come off the drug itself is no longer there to cover up all these painful things you've been experiencing. Because the drug is not suppressing your mental psychiatric symptoms alone. It's suppressing all your symptoms, including the ones it's causing. So it's complicated. And I should slow down for a second. I'm just checking my time here. I should slow down for a second and say that these neurotoxic drugs have all the adverse effects you can expect from neurotoxic drugs. It is practically impossible to prove they're helpful, even in the short run, It takes manipulating. It takes making sure it's only a few weeks when the drugs will be taken for months and years, and they'll tell you to take them for a lifetime. It takes buying experts. All the experts are bought. So it just takes all this rigmarole to even try to get a statistically significant effect. And often that effect comes because the doctors can tell the difference between who's on placebo and who isn't, because the patients on placebo aren't having the adverse effects. So they know that you're on Abilify because you're getting agitated, very common with Abilify. They know that. Or you're having trouble sleeping, very common on antidepressants. Or you're sleeping more deeply, very common on antidepressants. It can go either way. So they know. They have the bias. They know who's on the drugs. Even though it's supposed to be double blind, they're not supposed to know who's on the drug. They know. It's the patients who are having adverse effects. So they judge the drugs as helping because that's what they're paid to do. It's what they want to think. It's what their identity says. Because again, if they gave a negative result to one trial, I tell you, they will not be called back again. Drug companies have been known to keep doctors who are described as having cheated by the FDA until they're told to stop. They get rid of them. Now, what do long-term studies show about whether drugs are helpful? Well, there are none. There are no good, reasonable studies, long-term, of psychiatric drugs showing that they are good for you. None. Why? Well, first of all, they're not. They're neurotoxins. They're not going to be good for you long-term. I mean, that's the short of it. They don't help people long term. And many of the people who are taking the drugs are dropping out like flies when they can. So you don't even have good control groups to create. So here we're in a situation where we know this huge array of adverse effects are many of them life threatening. Every single drug with its own particular severe neurotoxic result, every one of them fitting the profile not of a corrective agent, not like giving insulin and your blood sugar comes down and you're no longer in diabetic coma, or giving penicillin and the bugs are stopped from reproducing or they're killed and you notice your cough is going away. None of them correcting anything that's going on in the body, because there is nothing to correct. These folks who are coming to psychiatrists don't have physical disease. They have emotional, spontaneous problems. All of us have emotional, spontaneous problems. There's nothing in this to fix biologically, or if there is, we have a disease. You know, like Alzheimer's, you know, or diabetes. And that isn't going to be helped, including Alzheimer's, by a psychiatric drug. So in fact, if you have a real disease like Parkinsonism, Alzheimer's, diabetes, last thing you want to do is add a psych drug to it, for God's sakes. So if you did have a biochemical imbalance of some sort that we don't know about, God's sakes, you don't want to get 10 more imbalances from a psych drug, because every psychiatric drug puts the whammy directly on at least one neurotransmitter day one. And then as the brain compensates in multiple ways, I describe in my books, multiple neurotransmitter defects and biochemical defects and imbalances are being produced. They spread throughout the brain because these neurotransmitter systems that are being whammied, like serotonin or dopamine, they go everywhere. In fact, you take a serotonin drug and it's immediately going to start affecting dopamine, because dopamine tries to compensate for what serotonin's doing. I mean, it's just infinitely complex. So it makes no sense at all to think you're being helped. And what people need good psychotherapy, And if your therapist refers you for a drug, that means your therapist doesn't think they can help you anymore. You ask instead for a referral and really don't even do that. You find another therapist, for God's sakes. I mean, when you tell a patient, I can't help, I want you to take a psychiatric drug, and you're not, you're a therapist or a clinical social worker, psychologist, you're saying, we can't do this together. Don't go along with that. That's like going out on a date with somebody and they think that you're not interested in them, so they give you a roofie. It really is. It's like that, only it's professionally done. Should be criminal. It's just untrue. You're asking some psychiatrist to drug your patient so they'll stay with you? Nonsense. If I'm not helping somebody, I do a thorough evaluation. I talk to the patient about it. I say, I don't want to lose you. I mean, I really like you, but you're free to go somewhere else. But you could also get help from another therapist while you're seeing me. Maybe another person will see things I'm not. Or maybe a different kind of therapy approach. You know, I'm very interpersonal. I'm very engaged. You know, I try to talk to what's going to help you. Not that if I can't help you, the mighty therapist, you need drugs. And yet that's the routine behavior that's going on now. So there is a lot of good ways to get help. I write about it in my books. I give courses on it. Look on my website for courses for how to help people, how to improve the lives of other people, how to improve your own life, how to help people when they're coming off psychiatric drugs. And what people need is a caring, responsible, experienced helper who knows how to help you have better relationships in your life, better goals, better values. That's what living life is all about. It is not about everything psychiatry is telling you. I hope that this has been of great help to you. I hope that you'll really get an idea about the overview of what's really going on with psychiatric drugs. Listen to the radio show, go to my website and Breggin.com, please, and go to Dr. Breggin's YouTube channel. Thank you very, very much. Thanks for listening and watching.